Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, December 6, 2018. A network of international lawyers sued the government of South Sudan for allowing sexual violence against women across the country.
We're representing a 12-year-old girl who was raped in front of her sister and her neighbor by the members of the government soldiers. We're representing a woman who was gang raped in front of her children.
And diplomats speak against gender-based violence in South Sudan.
Having legislation in place, investigating and prosecuting perpetrators are obviously key issues. However, most of all, violence also needs to be prevented by changing a culture of discrimination.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The executive director of the Legal Action Worldwide, a non-profit network of think tank and human rights lawyers, has filed the first case against the government of South Sudan for sexual violence on behalf of 30 South Sudanese women and girls who were raped by members of the South Sudan Army and the Presidential Guard. Antonia Malvi accused the South Sudan Army of what she calls brutal sexual violence, including sexual slavery, sexual torture, rape and gang rape against women and girls. The case was lodged in Geneva today at the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women.
All of them were raped and gang raped and some subjected to sexual slavery. And they're now refugees and asylum seekers in the neighboring country of Uganda and unable to currently return to South Sudan. And it's only because they are not in South Sudan that we've been able to take their statements.
This case is going to be lodged at the UN Committee on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in Geneva. Could you tell me the process and how is South Sudan going to be, you know, held accountable?
They will review the complaint and a copy will be sent to the South Sudan government for comment. It's for this reason that we have protected the identities of the survivors who've made the complaint against the government. And then we will be able to comment on behalf of our client.
I understand that you have worked with Rohingya women in Asia, and you've addressed the same situation there, mostly sexual violence. You've offered them legal intervention. Could you tell us some of your success stories with such cases?
In the Rohingya crisis, we're representing 400 Rohingya women and girls in a victim submission before the International Criminal Court. It is currently the only complaint that has been filed on behalf of Rohingya women and girls. This will be a decision that will be made by the ICC if they decide to open up an investigation. And we want to put forward the voices of the women and girls that we represent, and particularly ask the International Criminal Court to focus on the very serious sexual violence that took place during the clearance operations of August 2017 by the Myanmar military.
This particular case about the situation in South Sudan and the case against the South Sudan Army and the Presidential Guard, is this something that is going to go to ICC?
John, at this time, we can't say that this case will go to the ICC. However, what we want to do by lodging this complaint at the UN committee is to remind the international community of the brutal sexual violence that is taking place on a daily level against tens of thousands of South Sudanese women and girls, babies as young as 2 years old. And at the moment, there is very few opportunities for legal redress. It is possible if a member state referred the case to the ICC, but currently that's not happening at the moment, so we don't anticipate it to happen.
You mentioned that most of these girls who came to speak to you, women and girls who came to speak to you, are so afraid of the reprisal from the government, and that is why the identities are kept confidential. But would you mind to share some of the testimonies from these women?
Yes, we're representing a 12-year-old girl who was raped in front of her sister and her neighbor after they were raped by the members of the government soldiers. We're representing a woman who was gang raped by four government soldiers in front of her children. She had to flee the country. We're representing a 16-year-old girl who was 14 at the time, who was abducted from the bush, detained in a military compound, and gang raped during that time. All of them brutal stories, and unfortunately, just a snapshot and representation of what's happened to thousands of South Sudanese women and girls, frequently physically and mentally tortured before they're raped, and frequently the rape or the gang rape taking place in public spaces or in front of their family members.
Cases like this that you're talking about were previously reported by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the response from the government of South Sudan is normally that such cases are just aimed at tarnishing their image or such reports are false. How would you react to them if they dismissed this case where you have spoken to people who went through this rape?
Unfortunately, it's extremely common that governments deny the actions of their state agents, which includes the military, police, or border guard police. So the standard response, particularly to sexual violence, is to deny that it occurred in the first place. Under international law, the testimony of one individual is sufficient and counts as evidence. We have 30 statements from individuals who are raped, gang raped, and some subjected to mass gang rape. I think the information supported by UN and credible international NGO reports such as Amnesty International speaks for itself. And the denial of the government, I mean, just shows and indicates their unwillingness to address this issue.
That's Antonia Mulvey, Executive Director of Legal Action Worldwide, a non-profit network of think tank and human rights lawyers. Mulvey was speaking with me from Beirut, Lebanon, yesterday. The ambassadors of Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, and Canada in South Sudan are calling on authorities in Juba to implement laws that prohibit gender-based violence in the country. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Speaking today at a Juba event marking the campaign to end violence against women in South Sudan, diplomats say the government should hold the perpetrators of sexual crimes accountable to demonstrate their commitment to stopping sexual violence against women and girls.
Having legislation in place, investigating and prosecuting perpetrators are obviously key issues. However, most of all, violence also needs to be prevented by changing a culture of discrimination and empowering women in society. Women's voices must be heard, and their role in society as leaders and influential individuals must be secured.
Today's event is part of the 16 days of activism to end sexual violence against women, which kicked off 2 weeks ago in South Sudan. Last week, Doctors Without Borders said it treated 125 women and girls who were raped, beaten, and brutalized in South Sudan's Rupkona County between November 19 and 29. Janet Albada, the Netherlands ambassador to South Sudan, says authorities in South Sudan must act to prevent more sexual attacks.
Violence against women must stop. So here, all of our staff at the Joint Embassy compound shall remain committed to this fight 365 days a year.
Ambassador Anderson says the government and other institutions should put more effort into changing the culture of discrimination against women, educate South Sudanese girls, and build leadership skills among women. The 16 Days of Activism is an international campaign to challenge violence against women and girls across the world. The campaign runs every year from November 25th to December 10th, which is the Human Rights Day. Esther Ikere Eluzai, the Undersecretary of South Sudan's Ministry of Gender and Social Welfare, says the government is working to enact laws on gender-based violence in the country.
We are fighting this vice as a government to ensure that also our citizens, particularly women and girls, live a life free of violence, dignity, and they also enjoy their human rights in this country. So it's a common call to all of us to ensure that all of us have to fight this vice in the society.
The senior government official says the Kir administration has launched investigations into the Bentiu attacks and says her government will release a report next week. The United Nations Mission Chief in South Sudan, David Sierra, described the Bentiu attacks as abhorrent and said they were carried out by young men in military uniforms and civilian clothing. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Since South Sudan declared its independence in 2011, authorities in Juba authorized English as the country's official language. John Taban, a South Sudanese who went to school in Arabic, says South Sudanese need more time to shift to English language because Arabic has strong foundation in the lives of many South Sudanese. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Abraham Mariak is the owner of Al-Mogif, a daily Arabic newspaper published in Juba. He says he started two English papers and one in Arabic immediately after South Sudan's independence, but had to shut down the two English papers because of tough competition and skyrocketing inflation.
An Arabic version has so many readers, and they can cover the cost of it from the sales in the market. That is why it is still now operating. And which was not the same case in the rest two newspapers. We have a challenge of cost of the print. We have universal print in Juba here. It's very expensive.
Mariak says Arabic will remain a language of communication across the country. He says many institutions like the South Sudan Army still use Arabic as a language of instruction. And he notes public rallies and military parades are still conducted in Arabic.
I believe in the coming 20 years, Arabic will remain one of very important languages in South Sudan. Maybe it will be like Swahili in Kenya.
Ahmed Yagub manages Al-Watan, another Arabic newspaper. He says there are more people with an Arabic background compared to English in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, he says foreigners are struggling to learn Arabic because it is the language of trade and communication in South Sudan.
The future of Arabic language is wide comparing to the English language, and English is restricted politically and to some educated people, but the majority speak Arabic language, and it will continue and might dominate and become popular than English language.
Rita John is a television host of the Misaha Hura, which means Conducive Environment, a program of the government-owned South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation. She says the government should allow both English and Arabic as official languages in the constitution.
I am presenting in Arabic because I studied public relations in the University of Sudan in Arabic. Because that time Sudan and South Sudan were having one curriculum, or the official language for Juba and Khartoum was Arabic. If you witness, most of the people who grew in Juba were taught in Arabic. A few of them knew English language.
Wadin Roni went to school when classes were taught in Arabic. He says he is optimistic that Arabic will remain a significant language in the country because English is only spoken in Greater Equatoria, but not in Greater Upper Nile and Greater Baragazal.
Many people can understand Arabic, whether young children or the elderly, you can easily send a message, but English will take a long process or time to be known by people. If you consider the places of Greater Upper Nile and Greater Bahar al-Ghazal, most of them use Arabic. For them to shift to English will take time. So with this, I see Arabic having a future in South Sudan.
John Taban, another Arabic-speaking Juba resident, agrees. Taban says it is hard for people to shift to English because many people who lived in Khartoum had a strong foundation in Arabic.
Most of the residents of South Sudan speak in Arabic language. Though they say it is Juba Arabic, it is a language which is a medium of communication in the community. Even though you go to the government institutions, the idea of the government to put English as an official language in the constitution after the independence of South Sudan in 2011. 7 years are not enough for South Sudanese to learn English.
Although the Constitution of South Sudan declares English as the country's official language, Arabic still remains the common language for trade and communication across the country. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a South Sudanese journalist complains of hostile media environment in the country. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today, and I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17, because at that time, we go out. We go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Committee to Protect Journalists will release its annual census of journalists imprisoned around the world on December 13. South Sudanese journalist Emmanuel Monchol has an active arrest warrant against him. Monchol says his paper was sued by a national minister who wants him arrested.
What actually happened is that early this year, between March and April, Madam Awud Dengashi, the Honorable Minister, the National Minister of Gender and Social Welfare, sued the Dawn newspaper over two allegations, which he considered defamatory. One was an opinion article written by a man called Deng Mario. In that article, criticized the Lionfed managing director, who is currently fired. He criticized him, claiming that he was mismanaging the Lionfed Corporation. And in that letter, Deng Mario seemed to have added that although he was failing, he got the job because his mother-in-law lobbied for him. And then the second allegation, which was considered defamatory by the Honorable Minister, was a letter signed by 16 executive chiefs of Greater Anantnag area, a constituency that he represents as an MP. It was an open letter addressed to His Excellency the President. And then in that letter, they lamented that the MP, who is Honorable Awud, was not paying attention to the local disputes that were taking lives of many people in the area. Now, I have been summoned and I'm asked to appear before the police.
If she's saying that your newspaper defamed her, did you give her any opportunity to correct the facts according to her?
She has not asked for an opportunity to correct. She demanded for compensation of about 3 million pounds in the court of law. So that was what she thought she deserved for the defamation if she wins the case.
But when you were running the initial story or the commentary from your contributors, did you ever thought of giving her an opportunity to defend herself?
It is not a new story. If a citizen has expressed his opinion, so we thought that she would have a right to reply. But the article was not directly against her. It was expressing the situation at the corporation at the time. Her son-in-law was the managing director.
And so let's take the case of the chiefs. The chiefs were complaining that she is not doing her work as the member of parliament representing that area. I mean, in an ideal situation, as an editor, you should have given her an opportunity to reply to the letters from the chiefs.
The problem with our ministers here in Juba, they have no access to the media. You try to call them, you don't have access to them. They only try to have access to the media when issues like this appear in the paper. So we tried our best to call, her phones were not going through.
Emmanuel, in a situation where you try to reach somebody and the phones were not going through, did you put it in your paper that you tried to reach her?
It was not written as a news article. It was put as an opinion article because usually open letters are considered opinion. We just publish it as it was received. We try to call to put her in the picture that there is an open letter, an opinion from the deputy chiefs, from her constituency against her, but we are not able to reach her.
And what are your lawyers going to do now with this active arrest warrant against you? What are your lawyers doing?
My lawyer has to appear before anything goes on, but already the police is on after me, so I will go to the and find out what they will do.
Just tell us a little bit about the media environment in South Sudan. How is it like?
So the environment here is very tough. In May this year, I was attacked at my office at 8 o'clock in the evening. So I shifted from my office to another place. So here we try just to hang up because we don't have the protection. Even our leaders, when something small like this happens, they don't have the heart to forgive. Even if the president forgives, they cannot forgive down here. And that makes the life of the media person very difficult in this country.
That's Emmanuel Monchol, editor of the Juba-based Dawn newspaper. He spoke with me from Juba on Monday. From Juba, we move to Sudan. The Speaker of Sudan's parliament says he has received a letter signed by a majority of lawmakers supporting a constitutional amendment to allow President Bashir to seek another term in 2020. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi tells James Bhatti the move is a smokescreen.
It is quite expected. They have been gathering the support to violate the constitution, to have another term for the president. But the funny thing now, they say it might be for life, that they can renew for him the terms for unlimited times. This is not the first time that such so-called reforms for the constitution are done to solidify the strength of the new president and to give him more powers. And they have been harassing even members of the ruling party not to object to such reform.
Madam, the Speaker of the Parliament, Ibrahim Ahmed Omar, says that he has received a memorandum from 33 political parties who are representing 294 deputies to amend the Constitution. And he says that this is in line with the Constitution.
Well, he is talking about the procedure aspect of having reform from within the constitution for the constitution. Of course, this is the first step. Then the second step, to have the approval of the parliament, they have to take it to the both chambers, the House of Senate, the parliament, in different sessions, and they must get 3/4 of the votes of the two chambers. Then it is supposed to go to be taken to a referendum by the people. Of course, this is all, as you see, there is a lot of expenditure of time and effort and money, resources in that, for something which is already quite nonsensical. This president, sitting president, has been sitting for the last 30 years with the secession of the country, with wars widespread in all over Sudan, and with serious economic collapse to the extent now people are ordered to buy the bread through providing their national numbers. And there is serious inflation with corruption and lack of transparency and lack of basic freedoms and serious violations of human rights everywhere. So for such a devastating rule to ask to change the constitution to get another term or unlimited terms of governance, this is a serious manifestation, not only of autocracy, but total lack of vision by the ruling junta.
That's Mariam Al-Sadiq, Vice President of the UMA Party, speaking to my colleague James Bhatti. The Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to contain the Ebola outbreak. The outbreak is usual because more than 60% of patients are women. VOA's Anita Paul visited two Ebola hotspots and brings us this report from the town of Beni.
Baby Benedict's short life has already been unimaginably difficult.
At 1 month old, she is underweight at 2.9 kilograms. And she is alone. Her mother had Ebola and died giving birth to her. She spent the last 3 weeks of her life in a plastic isolation cube, cut off from most human contact. She developed a fever at 8 days old and was transferred to this hospital in Beni, a town of some 500,000 people in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 420 people have been diagnosed with Ebola here since the beginning of August, and more than half of them have died in a nation the size of Western Europe that struggles with insecurity and a lack of the most basic infrastructure and services. That makes this the second worst Ebola outbreak in history, after the hemorrhagic fever killed more than 11,000 people in West Africa between 2013 and 2016. This is the 10th outbreak to strike the vast country since 1976, when Ebola was first identified in Congo. And this particular outbreak is further complicated by a simmering civil conflict that has plagued this region for more than two decades. Dr. Guido Cornale, UNICEF's coordinator in the region, says the scope of this outbreak is clear.
It has become the worst outbreak in Congo, and this is not a mystery.
What is mysterious, however, are the demographics of this outbreak. This time, more than 60% of cases are women, says the government's regional health coordinator, Dr. Jokolo Tambwe-Bate. All the analyses, he said, show that this epidemic is feminized. Figures like this are alarming. It's true that the female cases are more numerous than the male cases. Dr. Bate declined to predict when the outbreak might end, though international officials have said it may last another 6 months. Epidemiologists are still studying why this epidemic is so skewed toward women and children, Dr. Cornale said.
So now we can only guess. And one of the guesses is that the women are the caretakers of sick people at home. So if a family member got sick, who is taking care of him or her? Normally a woman.
Or a nurse. Many of those affected are health workers who are on the front line of battling this epidemic. Nurse Gilen Mulindwa Masika spent 16 days in care after a patient transmitted the virus to her. She says it was the fight of her life.
So the douleur enorme, en tout cas de douleur vive, de maux de tête, de diarrhée.
The pain was enormous, she said, and the pain was constant. The headache, the diarrhea, the vomiting, and the weakness, it was very, very bad. For the afflicted, the road to recovery is long and lonely. Masika and her cured colleagues face weeks of leave from work to ensure the risk of infection is gone. In the main hospital in the city of Beni, families who have recovered live together in a large white tent, kept 4 meters from human contact by a bright orange plastic cordon. They yell hello at their caretakers, who must don protective gear if they want to get any closer. And for baby Benedict, who is tended to constantly by a nurse covered head to toe in protective gear, the future is uncertain. Medical workers aren't entirely sure where her father is, or if he is going to come for her. She sleeps most of the day, the nurse says, untroubled by the goings-on around her. Meanwhile, the death toll rises. Anita Powell, VOA News, Beni, Democratic Republic of Congo.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Hasada Mako by Isaka Number One. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Let us know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. If you plan to be out of Juba where there are no VOA FM stations, you can still listen to us on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kHz, 13865 kHz, and 15180 kHz. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Azúcar.